I'm Bruce Shapiro. I am the executive director of the DART Center for Journalism and Trauma, a project of Columbia Journalism School. This is the panel on sexual assault on campus investigations, lessons learned from both excellent work and problematic work over the last year. Before I do that, two quick housekeeping matters. First of all, remember that this session, as all sessions at IRE, is being recorded, so when we get to Q&A, please come up to the mic and don't say anything that you wouldn't want your grandmother or grandkids to hear. Secondly, the DART Center is in the middle of conducting a global survey of the impact of threat and harassment of various sorts on journalists all around the world. Here on the table, my colleague Alana Newman is leading this, here on the table, also on the table outside, there are cards that look like this, and on the back is a link to this survey. I would very much like to have IRE represented in good numbers in this. I think that the kinds of stresses, threats, and harassment that this particular constituency deals with are very important to document. So if you would do that at some point during the day, that would be great. In the many years now that I have been coming to IRE and in the sort of recent history of investigative journalism, one of the great changes and one of the great innovations has been the emergence of reporting on sexual assault and institutional responses, failures, and collusion in the victimization of women. Going back to the 90s and some of the first reporting on military sexual assault, going forward through the Boston Globe's and Boston Phoenix's remarkable reporting on the Catholic Church, in first the Archdiocese of Boston, then around the world, and forward. It's become a major subject for reporting. Institutions that have a duty of care and betray children or adults who are victims of sexual assault has become a central theme of investigative reporting in our time, that previously undealt with, undisclosed. It's a great achievement. This year, all of us who look at these issues had a big dose of cold water in the form of the controversy around Rolling Stone's story, a rape on campus. The subsequent report commissioned by Rolling Stone magazine itself, which my colleagues Steve Collin, Sheila Coronel co-authored. It's also been a year, however, in which there has been some superb, insightful, and groundbreaking reporting that has held up and done well. And we're lucky here to be able to talk about what the path forward is for investigative reporting on this issue, what lessons have been learned about best practice. We're going to talk about that today, not to do a retrospective finger-pointing at Rolling Stone. The report is out there. What it has to say is pretty clear. But rather to say, as journalists, can we keep reporting this issue at all? If so, how? What are the best practices, the most effective ways, and some innovative directions to go forward? We have a really diverse panel here to talk about it. It's also a crowded panel. So we will move through an initial round of questions and an initial round of presentations fairly quickly and then get to a conversation with all of you. I will be a fairly rigorous timekeeper just so we can land the plane on time and allow as many voices as possible to be heard. On the panel today with me are, first of all, Nicole Noren from CNN.
ESPN.
Enough caffeine to get letters in my brain, not enough to have them be the right ones. And with her, and we're especially glad to have Teresa Breckel here, who was the subject of one of Nicole's remarkable package of stories that Nicole and her reporting partner at ESPN worked on involving sexual assault in college sports and lack of accountability. And they will talk a little bit about their work, the relationship, how it went, some of the challenges and successes of that. To their my left, their left, is Sheila Carnell, who is the Dean of Academic Affairs at Columbia Journalism School, as well as the director of the Stabile Center for Investigative Reporting based at the school. And next to her is Dean Steve Call, the Dean of Columbia Journalism School, former managing editor of the Washington Post and president of the New America Foundation. They'll talk about their report. On my right is my colleague, Alana Newman. Alana is a clinical psychologist, professor of psychology at the University of Tulsa, and she also is the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma's research director, and has spent the last decade working very closely with us, both on studies of journalists and the impact of covering violence and tragedy on us, and on reporting practices involving survivors and victims of trauma. She works with rape survivors. She works with journalists. She'll sort of bridge the conversation in a different way. I thought we would start, because it's always good to start just with a story and to start with something that was done right, with Nicole. And this package that you put together for Outside the Lines, your series, talk a little bit about how it happened and how you ended up working with Teresa, what issues you found.
Hi, everyone. In January 2014, we aired and published a story on a former University of Missouri swimmer named Sasha Menucori. Sasha had struggled with borderline personality disorder, and actually it was made worse by an alleged rape that happened by one or more football players. And she ended up taking her own life, and that was a 16-month investigation that we did. And the day that story aired, I received an email from a woman named Teresa Breckel. And I had heard of Teresa's name because I knew that she had been the tutor. And that's the only thing I knew. She had just actually, for the first time, her name had been released in a book that came out a few months earlier. But before that, I only knew of her as the tutor. And by that, it was a very well-known story about 4 years earlier at this point. And a high-profile star there, the captain of the team, Derek Washington, a running back, had sexually assaulted the tutor that I knew of and gone through the whole criminal process. He actually was found guilty, went to prison for it, it was a 5-year sentence. He went for 90 days. And I'd always wanted to reach out to her, our story went in a different direction with Sasha. Never came into contact with her. And she wrote that night because she had actually known Sasha. And we started a dialogue. And based on our conversation, it prompted me and piqued my curiosity she had said she heard that there might have been something that happened before Mr. Washington assaulted her. And I wanted to know if something maybe perhaps had happened, and did a very general records request with campus police and city police, and was actually shocked to receive two previously, no one knew about these reports. There were two allegations of violence against women. One of them was another forcible rape that had happened before Teresa. And no one had reported this. It was a national story at the time, her trial. And so that's kind of how this story started snowballing. We eventually got in contact with the original accuser that it happened about a year and a half before mm-hmm. Teresa's incident, and so that was the genesis of our story. It was focusing with my reporting partner Paula Levine. We focused on two women that were assaulted by the same athlete, and it was very interesting because one of the cases, Teresa's, had been adjudicated, but the other one no one had ever heard of, and no one had known anything. The prosecutor had decided to not proceed with that case, even though the campus police sent him. We had the charging documents. The police believe a forcible rape had occurred, and we had we actually had an interview, a police interview with the player that no one had ever seen before, where he admitted that she said no numerous times and he proceeded and had sex with her. And So this is basically the genesis of the story. So it went from there.
Yeah. And Teresa, mm-hmm. you made the sort of the courageous decision not only to be part of the story, but ultimately to appear on camera, to mm-hmm. have your name used. What made it possible for you to have that kind of trust in Nicole? What was the process you followed, what the two of you followed, mm-hmm. to get the story there?
Well, thankfully, I had had one positive experience. I'd had some negative experiences prior to my involvement with the chapter in the book that Nicole had mentioned. So the system, Jeff Benedict, the author, had reached out to me, and I'm not going to lie, I did a little background check on him, and his colleagues praised him, and they said you'd be really lucky to work with him. So I moved forward with speaking with him and having an active role in that chapter being written. He approached me saying, you can be involved or you cannot, but I'm really going to kind of just use records if you don't want to be, in a very non-threatening way. Really, the door's open if you want to take a step through. So I took that step through, worked with him, and it came to a point where they were getting ready to publish, and it was, okay, so do I publish my name? I mean, I had never had my name really out there before. I had still been protected by victims' rights. And did I want to be a Jane Doe, or did I want my name to be tagged with it? And I thought I couldn't live with myself if I didn't include my name, because I am a person. I'm not a Jane Doe. And that doesn't mean that all the Jane Does out there are less courageous than myself. But I thought, I hope looking back, I'll be able to show this to my kids and say, here's something I tried to do. So then things progressed from there. As Nicole had mentioned, I emailed her. I watched the Sasha piece. I knew Sasha not well. We weren't by any means best friends, but I worked very closely with a lot of members of the Division I team at the University of Missouri, the swim team members, and reached out to her and said, basically, what can I do to help? I mean, I'm a little lost with what I'm supposed to be doing or what I could be doing. By then, my trial had already occurred. Derek had already served his sentence, and I still didn't feel like it was over after reading the things that Nicole had found out about the University of Missouri, and specifically with Sasha and with some other key players. So,
and let me just ask one more question, then maybe we'll take a look at a brief clip mm-hmm. from this. Nicole, there's one of the issues we've been talking a lot about this year is verification and mm-hmm. how to deal with victim stories, mm-hmm. right? And now in this case, there were facts that were adjudicated already, and in some ways that puts a lot on the record that's easier. But how did the two of you deal with any other additional levels that you had to do?
I've done quite a few of these stories now, whether it's sexual assault, sexual abuse, kind of in this, we've done quite a few stories on our show about it. I try to be incredibly patient and incredibly honest, and really be very open about the process, the reporting process with them as far as records that we're going to need to obtain. I really like to have survivors or victims or however they like. But by the way, I like to let them be called what they want to be called. I know I don't have to make assumptions about what stage they're in of their recovery, but I think the biggest thing is really making like a lot of communication and very, very upfront about what I'm going to be doing. So I think I like to really involve, oftentimes when you're trying to get records too, like say it's medical records, police, court records, you need cooperation from the people involved. So that is a helpful thing too. Then you can really gauge. So I knew Teresa. It was very unique because Teresa was very, she was very, very helpful and very engaged. And there was another woman in our piece who then had reached out to her. So then there was a very unique situation because this woman had never even known that anyone knew about it until I requested the police report. And so the police, for the first time, they called her and told her they were giving the police report to a media person. And so that, she heard her. So she went through the process from the very beginning. And it took months to really get Jess is her name, you're going to see her in the clip, to to get her to the point, like where she was to the point where she felt okay cooperating. And honestly, I didn't talk to her for probably 2 or 3 months because I felt like she was overwhelmed a little bit at first. Yeah. And just was, you know, very, very patient through the process and felt if she didn't want to cooperate, it's one of those things you cannot push people at all. And if they want, if they're not going to be ready to be able to participate in the story, then they're not ready to have their story out there on national television or in any way.
Right. And that's, and I think that's probably a point to underscore.
Yeah.
And that will come up later as we talk. Why don't we take a look at that mm-hmm. clip, which is just a few minutes long. Thanks, Steve.
Even though multiple two of Jess's rape allegations, including her academic advisor.
Hold on. There it is. That's it.
We got it, I think.
Okay, go. There we go. All right, well.
Even though multiple university officials knew of Jess's rape allegation, including her academic advisor and some football coaches, it's not clear whether any of these officials told the Title IX coordinator. But Outside the Lines has confirmed there was no Title IX investigation.
I'll tell you what, I think let's hold off on the clip. I think we'll just move on with conversation, I think. And, it's just, I think, going to take too long to download. So, Steve and Sheila, why don't you, let's move to the Rolling Stone piece now. We can revisit this if we have time, but the fundamental issues of establishing trust, of building that relationship, and also of making, Teresa, you were made a partner in verification.
Mm-hmm.
Really
mm-hmm.
Are at the heart of this. Steve and Sheila, you got to look at the Rolling Stone piece, A Rape on Campus, in real detail, wrote a big report describing a failure that didn't have to happen. Without rehashing that, talk about lessons going forward. I know you were going to divide up talking about reporters and editors and the responsibilities of each. Who wants, which of you guys
all right,
first?
Okay, let me start. Rape is one of the hardest crimes to report on. It's not like murder where you have a dead body or a theft where, you know, something has been stolen. Rape, you know, it's he said, she said, and it's really risky. And let me just talk of, like, you know, we have so little time. Let me talk of three risks in rape reporting and how those risks can be mitigated. One is, as we saw in Rolling Stone story, the risk of over-reliance on a single source. Most of the time, reporters have access to the victim. Very seldom do they have access to the accused or the alleged perpetrators. This risk can be mitigated by, one, getting contemporaneous accounts of the assault. Very often, when a victim has been assaulted, she talks to friends, she talks to family, she sends out text messages, she sends out emails. There's a documentary, there's a social media trail. Sometimes before an assault has occurred, people have taken photographs or cell phone video of a party scene or something, so you can corroborate. It is possible to corroborate a victim's account even without access, very often, to the accused through contemporaneous accounts as well as 911 calls and other stuff. Once an investigation has taken place, whether at the campus level, I mean, campus sexual assault is particularly challenging. All rapes are challenging to report. Campus rape particularly so because of the privacy restrictions on colleges and because universities are among the most secretive institutions. I know. We know because we work in one. So it is But at the same time, there's access to privacy waivers. When a victim allows her school records, for example, to be made available, there are different rules for private universities and for public universities, but privacy waivers can be issued, and it is possible to get certain documentation of adjudication processes that have taken place on campus. The second is the risk of empathy. I mean, empathy is not a problem, but it is risky for a journalist because by nature, journalists sympathize with people, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with empathy. It's an essential journalistic skill. But empathy can lead to biases, to blind spots in judgment. So how do you mitigate the risk of empathy? One is try not to establish a definitive account when that's not possible. So report what one side has said, report what the other side has said. When it's not possible to say conclusively, then you should say so. And you should be transparent about what you know and what you don't know. But the other way to do it is to get the other side as fully and completely as possible. In the case of the Rolling Stone, for example, the author went to the fraternity and said, "We've heard allegations of a rape or sexual assault that occurred in your fraternity. Can you comment?" That is not getting the other side fully and completely. The rule is no surprises. The other side should know, you know, should be given specific details of the allegations and be allowed to respond. The third risk is the risk of narrative, and we can take forever talking about this, but the search for the emblematic case often leads to blind spots. The choice of an emblematic case. The other risk in narrative is the omniscient tone, which was used in this case. In this case, if you read the Rolling Stone story, she describes the scenes as if it really happened, when based on details from just a single source, without telling readers how she knew what she knew and whether she had corroborated the facts to establish in the story. An omniscient narrative tone is okay if you have corroborated and verified. In this case, how do you guard against the risk of narrative is don't pretend omniscience when you do not have omniscience. when your only God can be omniscient. But being transparent with what you know is one guard against it. And also maybe shifting the focus a little bit. It is many times impossible to say for sure what happened in a rape. So maybe the shift toward will be to something more towards, this is an investigative reporting conference, towards accountability, showing how institutions and agencies responded to the assault. That can be documented, it's not reliant on two people's account of the crime, but looking at institutional responses and changing the framework from the narrative of an assault to a narrative of accountability is one way to mitigate those issues.
And I think, in fact, you can have the narrative and the narrative can get out of sync if the story is about one that's supposed to be about institutional accountability, but you write it, prepare it, centered around a sort of spectacular narrative, then the story's goals and the storytelling are out of sync, and
yes,
you get some big problems.
Exactly, as it was in this case.
Yeah. So, Steve, you've now had a few months to digest your own work on this report. You've been an editor. What are the lessons for editors going forward on stories like this?
I think the most specific one that I wouldn't have guessed at going in, even as someone with sort of officer of the court responsibilities at a university, is how if you're going to engage with this work on campuses these days, and I hope you will, it's very important work. You have to recognize as an editor that the adjudication system that is the context for the stories you're reporting on is a work in progress. And it's also highly dynamic and complicated compared to the adjudication systems that you're accustomed to reporting around in the criminal justice system. And so if you're going to serve your reporter and your readers well, I came to understand, you actually have to acquire an education about these systems in a greater level of detail than you would normally educate yourself about the courts that are adjudicating a murder case. because it's for two reasons. One, you have to understand where the evidence is in the system and why it's protected, how it's protected in order to access it or at least take a shot at accessing it. And the rules that govern where the evidence is held, who has access to it, what rights are trying to be protected around the evidence are very different from in the regular justice system, and they're different from in the military justice system too. And they're being rewritten almost every 6 months in the form of memos from the Department of Education civil rights offices to campuses saying this is how you have to do it. And campuses themselves are reinventing their own systems for managing evidence as they take on these responsibilities in greater detail. So it's just, if you're going to be helpful as an editor, you're going to have to get into the details of this. The second reason for acquiring the education is to make judgments about the case, the particular circumstances of a case that you might be working. How does it fit in the broader landscape of cases that are being adjudicated? Has it been adjudicated? Why, if not, why not? That was a critical issue in the Rolling Stone case. This case had not been adjudicated, and why not would have been a way to kind of go down the road and say, okay, is this the story we want to be investing in? So that was one kind of practical thing I took away from it. The other more familiar aspect of this that I would just set in that context is that there, of course, there's a false choice between verification and empathy. But figuring out how to communicate effectively with a survivor who has made the brave decision to come forward and participate in the story is a proposition that most reporters have not had a lot of time to think about and work through, other than those who have committed themselves to this field. And so it requires collaboration. It requires an editor to help create an environment in which all of the decisions that are being made around the story are really being discussed and worked through in a constructive way. And in the Rolling Stone case, you know, there were a lot of reasons why the collaboration between editors and reporter didn't work, but it was really ultimately the responsibility of editors to create a different kind of conversation around a story like that. And that starts with recognizing that this work is hard and that the institutional setting that you're working in is not familiar. It's just not familiar. It is a brand new thing if you're on campus doing this work.
Okay, I was going to move the mic a little closer to you. I've just been instructed that all of us should be talking a little closer to the mic because it's hard to hear him back. Thank you. Alana, you have in some ways been on all sides of this issue. You train and advise journalists who are interested in covering these issues, and you've watched exemplary work emerge from that. You saw the Rolling Stone story unfold and everything else. You counsel assault survivors, have treated folks, and you also participate in your own university's reform efforts around sexual assault and gender harassment.
If you have a conflict of interest, just create a lot of them, and then you're set.
How have you, as this unfolded and as we've been talking now, what's been on your mind?
Well, a lot of the things that I wanted to highlight, I think, have already been said. That I really, these stories, I think, are so important, and I hope that you are not scared at all by this year's events, but continue to study them, continue to cover them, because they're so needed. And new perspectives are so needed in this area. So I am, and among the psychologists, and I would say also members of the societies that I'm a member of, we value the work of investigative reporters, and it's really important that the stories of trauma survivors get told, and they get told well. And I think that verification, when I'm in my clinical role, don't need to do that, but it is so important for you to get the story right, because the damages, if you don't, are major. So I think we've already talked about how to improve the encounters with survivors, which is giving control to the person, collaborating, as you just talked about, Nicole, being explicit that you're not blaming a person, but you really do need to get other records, and here's why. Many people don't understand how journalism works, and it's really important, particularly to someone who's lost control, to explain the rules of the game. I know you don't explain the rules of the game to people in power, but to people who are disempowered, you need to explain your operating assumptions. And that really, I think, could give a sense of control, and I don't know if you would find that that was the case for you. The more you understood, Teresa, the easier it was to collaborate.
Yes. I appreciated that Nicole was very specific with what she maybe was looking for and what maybe she needed from me, because there was really no one else to ever help me navigate the process that I went through. So I had already gone through the criminal process with little to no instruction as to what to do or what to expect. And then then started to go into this process with records and finding things that, as an average person, I didn't know how to do any of this. But I held some of the keys, if you will, to unlocking those doors, and was more than happy to do so. But without some kind of guidance and consistent communication, and just Nicole was just very frank with me. Here, you know, here's what I would need, or here's what we're looking for. Please do this. And it was great because I never felt like I had to do it or else she would be upset with me. She was just always very, very clear with me, which I appreciated.
Were there any points where the two of you had to negotiate a little bit? Was there anything that you encountered, or maybe in your earlier work with the writer?
I don't think so. The thing that I wanted to give a tip kind of about the whole, whenever you're doing these stories and dealing with these institutions, now I'll speak mainly about just public institutions right now, because it's a whole different ballgame with the private ones. But I found a really great tool. You're never going to truly find out what happened and how a school reacted unless you actually have a FERPA waiver and you unlock FERPA and not let them hide behind that. We were able to truly find out what had happened with Teresa and with the other women in our story once I had them sign a FERPA waiver and giving us the right to access all of their records. That truly is the only way you can really know what happened, how people responded, the process. Like, as Steve said, it's very complicated when you're dealing with these campus disciplinary hearings and even the police involved, the campus police. So that's a huge, it's really important to get that. And another way it's important, I think it's when you're dealing with people who have not gone through a process where they have not had a hearing on campus or they have not had a prosecutor decide to take the case. When you're trying to have them participate and get records with you, I actually really go out and I really think it's very important to get medical records as well, including psychiatric records, because it helps me verify that their stories have been consistent over time. And it also helps, it's just really valuable to get those too. But one benefit from that is to see how willing someone is to get that stuff, to me, is a sign that they are confident with their story as well, and it has their account of what happened. If someone hesitates and doesn't want to do that stuff and help you find out what had happened and what happened at the school, to me, it would be a red flag that I shouldn't proceed with that person and being involved in the story. So it's great. It's like a twofold thing to go through that process.
And I think building on that, and it may be controversial, but among other people who've done these stories and done long-term stories, people drop out after lots of times investigating, and I think that it may make sense up front to have that conversation about, we want to name you, have you talked to your family members, have you thought about what it will be like for future people to see that, and there's less sense of privacy among college students these days, but I think it's a conversation to have early on instead of later. But the timing needs to be thought about. But I do think that's a discussion to have early on. I also think I would frame it a little bit different. I agree absolutely 100% about this issue of over-empathizing, but I actually think I would frame it a little differently, which is I think when you tell these stories, it's very easy to take sides. In my view, the view of trauma is that it fractures your sense of balance, particularly your sense of how much you want to know and not know. So I call it approach and avoidance. And I think that your audiences struggle with it, your sources struggle with how much do I want to go back to it, how much do I want to be immersed in it. And I think that you as journalists also struggle with it on taking sides. And it's hard not to take sides when there's an injustice. You all know that. And I think one of the lapses or things that you're not as trained in is how do you find an emotional balance. And I would say that I think that it's about over-identification that sometimes leads to blind spots, because you get angry, you start seeing injustices, you're trying to find information, you're getting blocks, and that in itself is an area in where you have to take a deep breath and you have to think about, I'm in this dilemma, and really check yourself and use your critical thinking. And I think that sometimes in the best interest of a story that can go blind, but I'm not sure I would call it empathy. I would call it more of being caught in that dilemma of approach and avoidance, because I think you have to have empathy throughout to tell the story well. The only other things that I'll say very quickly, because I think the conversation's far more important, is that there are lots of reasons why people's stories are inconsistent. It's that approach avoidance I talked about. It's crime victims of all kind, and you can find it from Holocaust survivors to human rights people. Typically, people remember in a point of fear the most central, the things they consider important and not the periphery. And often you're asking about things that are the periphery, and they're that's the central. That's going to happen. Memories change over time. Memory's imperfect. I think that's why having records and corroborative kinds of stories are important. Memories are stored differently. Most memories that we know of are stored sequentially. Normal memories, they make sense. But the way traumatic memories are stored, they come back full force in pieces and are not clear. And that can be scary for the person, and it can be difficult for you. And you have to learn to work with those. And I think probably that's a good place for me to stop with my comments.
Okay. We can go to questions from the room. Line up at the mic. I'm going to start by asking you, Alana, one question. And among other things, Alana is a wonderful what we know, what we don't know kind of person. What do we know about false reporting of sexual assault?
We don't know that much, but what we know is that false report, it does happen. It happens far less than false reporting of any other kind of crime. You're more likely to have false reporting of muggings and of robberies and things like that than you are. It does happen. I think we probably over-respond to that, that worry. But it does occur, and it's something we need to think about. But it is a fairly low probability. But it does happen.
Now, I see there are a lot of people lining up. We have 20 minutes, so keep your questions focused, sharp, and brief.
I'm Carol Curry from the Statesman Journal in Salem, Oregon. I'd like to drop down one age group. I'm doing campus assaults on high schools, and I'm running into a huge problem with school districts hiding behind student records laws. I reported on the rape of a 14-year-old girl by her basketball coach. He pleaded guilty. He's in prison, but no one wants to talk on the source level, not the school district. I've got FOIA on speed dial. But the parents of other children and the children themselves don't want to talk because of the social media castigation. We all know how cruel young kids can be, and you know, Twitter and Facebook have exacerbated that. Do you have any suggestions for how to, you know, penetrate that don't want to talk?
On the DART Center website, I will say, there is a little booklet and some tip sheets on reporting on children and trauma, and that extends up to teenagers. And there are also, which is very helpful advice about different kinds of negotiation you can do with families and with advocates and with others. Also, somewhere I believe we have a tip sheet from Rachel DeSell of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, who's not here this weekend, but who did the Steubenville sexual assault and bullying case, some remarkable reporting on there that involved very much the question of social media shaming, and she was able to get trust in that community and make a story of it. So I would direct you there.
Let me just say, I talked to several reporters who've done work on sexual assault, and the way to get them to talk is to spend a lot of time. One reporter I spoke to said he had 20 visits to the parents before he even talked to the victim herself. So it means investing a lot of time, months and months of work.
I wonder, this is very difficult. And I wonder if presenting on this issue itself, what is the cost of talking about bad things in our community and having kids talk about that kind of issue in of itself is an ends to a mean in raising the issue in the community, and then maybe people will come forward.
Hi, I'm Samantha Sunny, I'm a freelance reporter. I have a question about the FERPA waivers. So if you're obtaining records that identify the accused student, the perpetrator, don't you also need a FERPA waiver from them if they're being identified?
Yeah, in many cases, if they are named. Sometimes it depends on how aggressive the lawyers are at the school as to whether they would send put something and just redact the names. But there are documents and things that you can get and information. Just for instance, in our story, we wanted to know if a Title IX investigation had occurred in the first victim in our story back in 2008. We structured the questions to the school and through the records request. We got that through a records request, but we structured it in a way that allowed them to answer without having to identify him, so they couldn't hide behind it. So we asked it in a way that you can get around it. But you're right; they do sometimes hide behind that. So you just have to kind of come up with really creative ways to get them to answer and force them to answer.
A very good resource in this is the Student Press Law Center, sblc.org. They have guides for navigating FERPA. I believe if a finding has been made against a student, the name can be made public, can be released.
It can be, but most schools hide behind it and say they won't still release it. FERPA allows them to release it, but most say it's our choice and we're not releasing it. But you can ask it in a way where it won't identify. If you ask if an accuser had a Title IX investigation or any kind of, like, you can figure out ways. It just have to be really creative and super persistent.
Hi, Morgan True with Vermont Digger. We had a situation in just recently where a state senator was charged with sexual assault, and the judge had asked that the victim's identities be filed separately and sealed. But the state's attorney, when he filed the affidavit of probable cause, included all of the victims' IDs as well as contact information. And I just wanted to hear from you guys about the journalistic ethics of contacting the victims in that case, especially when you know all of your competitors have that information and it's a high-profile case.
Teresa, is that something you have had experience with?
Well, I did. That was my negative experience prior to the positive one I had shared. I didn't speak with anyone directly after my case until the prosecuting attorney finally called me and said, okay, well, we're going to move forward with this. It had happened a little over a year after my assault had actually occurred. And the day that Mr. Washington was removed from the University of Missouri football team was the day that my phone didn't stop ringing. I had filed a restraining order against him. When I met with the University of Missouri Police Department, they said, here are your options to protect yourself. And my fear of him coming after me was very, very real at that point. It still is today. And I filed that restraining order, and all of my personal information was on there. So when I started to get those phone calls, some of which were very threatening and were very scary to me, I wondered, how did they find me? Like, how? I'm no longer a student. I don't live there. I had moved home. But my cell phone number was on those records. I thought I had filled them out to my best knowledge. So I was threatened. I was sent every form of communication you can think of from journalists, to a point where they said, well, we're just going to print this. We're going to print your name. We're going to print everything that's happened to you. And I had an absolute breakdown. My trial had not yet occurred, and I thought, what is going on? How am I not protected? And that's when my prosecuting attorney had to step in, because I didn't know what to do at that point. I didn't know what resources I had, who was telling me, you know, the truth. And a lot of the journalists said, well, tell us, you know, be my friend. And I said, I didn't respond to any of them, just because I thought silence was my best option at that point, instead of speaking to anyone.
I mean, I would just say it sounds like silence was your best option, but as a matter of journalistic ethics and the way you asked it, if you have a conflict between a prosecuting attorney and a judge, and names are disclosed in the public record by a prosecuting attorney, and the question is, should you make a respectful, empathetic call? Yes, I think you, if you are interested in the story and you believe you can serve the public interest by advancing it ethically, there would be no reason to stand down, in my judgment.
What about ethically, then, if in the interview the victim gave an account that contradicted what they told the police, or contradicted aspects of what they told the police?
that's too situational to do in, in a big room. But yeah, so then you talk to your editors and you work it forward.
Mm-hmm. But do bearing in mind, A, what Alana was talking about the nature of traumatic memory and stories, B, that with something that is being adjudicated, there's a legal process going on in parallel to whatever your journalistic work is, and you do, I think, have an ethical obligation to be careful about not disrupting a proper judicial process that can bring justice to a victim. So there's interesting stuff there.
Thank you, guys. Hi, I'm Ted Canova, news director at WGBH in Boston. And Teresa, first, thanks for being here. Nicole, you had mentioned that if a victim or survivor isn't quite ready, that means they're not ready for their story to go public either. So if you were able to confirm everything that you confirmed with her help, but she said, one, she didn't want to participate, and two, she didn't want you to do the story, what would you have said to her?
I wouldn't include her. It's hard because it's different when you have TV and print. Like you just have so much more anonymity when you are only having the print factor. As far as like someone using their name, we actually struggled. The clip you would have seen, she actually was silhouetted, and we used a pseudonym. We used a different name for her because she lived in the area and was very, very worried about, because of, I think, what had happened to, she watched what had happened to Teresa and saw the message board. Teresa was taken apart in the media and in message boards and all over in the college town. And her experience is she was deathly afraid of anyone. She wanted to speak. So to answer your question, if someone really doesn't want to participate, it's hard to go forward with a TV story if they back out. But it's very situational as well too. Like sometimes that you could include them in a way that wouldn't, that really wouldn't identify them, and that could perhaps help. Kind of, it's kind of specific. Sorry.
Okay. There's one interesting thing here, which is that in this story you had a named survivor, Teresa, and you had, and another as well, but then you also did have one anonymous masked person. If you had only had, if Teresa had been willing to tell her story, give the details, have it verified, but insisted on anonymity, and you only had two anonymous sources, mm-hmm. would you have gone with it, do you think? Two pseudonymous sources, I should say.
They both wanted to cooperate?
And they both were cooperating, yeah. But didn't want their names and images used. Would you have still done the story?
I think, well, we had so much documentation, and we had a police interview with the man. So I think we would have proceeded with it because we had so much evidence. I think we would have proceeded with that because we had enough that we could document through all the records and all the reporting we had done over 9 months.
Great. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Marmy, and I'm the news director at KPBS Public Media in San Diego. And J97, so hi, Steve and Sheila and Bruce. Thank you guys for being here. It's a great panel. So we were reporting on campus rapes before the Rolling Stone story came out. Thank goodness. I have a question from sort of more an editor point of view. Working with the reporter on the story, and we went through all of the challenges of the empathy, and it was very hard on her psychologically. Understandably, but then in reaching out to the male assailant, and it was factually out there that he did it, so I don't have to say alleged. He lives in our community. I mean, this happened on the campus where we broadcast from, and so she'd see him around town. And I really had sort of a manager editor quandary of how do we handle her interviewing him? Of course, I want her to do that for this story, but her safety could be at risk. So I started having creative ideas of, maybe we'll have a guy who's not on the story interview. I don't know, just anything you can speak to from the sort of the editor's point of view of how to really help our reporters through a very difficult assignment.
The anxiety was that the reporter feared that she would be targeted by
yes.
this man or his
right,
friends.
Right,
because
she's a public
something.
Figure, She,
the
she's known in our community,
figure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, we're on the air. We do radio, TV, web, so we're everywhere.
Yeah. Well, it's not an unusual dilemma when you're a journalist in a conflict society or other places. You go interview people and you put yourself at risk. I think my instinct would be to try to work through with the reporter an approach to the interview and the aftermath of the interview that would make her comfortable with doing it herself rather than working around it by sending another person to do the interview. That would be my instinct. But if in working it through with her, you know, her anxieties were so well-grounded and severe that she really didn't feel that she could complete the work that she had set out to do by carrying out the interview herself, then you could think about alternative approaches. Presumably the problem is what she's going to be targeted after this, not the safety of conducting the interview itself. So if so, then there are lots of ways to do an interview with a dangerous person in a public place that makes you feel as, you know, as safe as it's humanly possible to feel. That tradecraft is easier to manage than the kind of deeper, the aftermath stuff. You know?
I mean, I would just add one thing to that, which is that the physical safety of the reporter is crucial, and if you're talking about someone with a real history as a violent felon, do pick public places, have a third person present for the interview, do those kinds of things. But also, you might want to have a talk with the reporter about managing her own information and boundaries, making sure that her mobile phone number is not known, if that's, you know, doing whatever, taking reasonable steps to protect her own privacy on this and other stories. It's not just about this story. So that it's a little harder for people to penetrate a reporter's sort of zone of privacy and do scary things.
Well, one idea I even considered was to have her use a different byline, but that really felt ethically squishy.
Well, what others have done in countries where it's dangerous, they don't use a byline or they have multiple people doing the same thing so that the risk is spread out.
Yeah, we thought of just a KPBS news byline, which would be a shame because it was amazing reporting.
So we have 5 minutes and 1, 2, 3, 4 questions, so you each get to go quickly. Ask a question.
Hi, I'm Allie Donnelly from NECN. It's an NBC-owned station in Boston. Teresa, thank you. This is really powerful to have you here. I'm listening to you as a reporter and as a parent, and a lot of this reporting is fantastic, but it's reactionary, right? Someone gets hurt, and you're looking to make change and do all of these things. But I think of those stats, those 1 in 4 stats or whatever they are, and I'm terrified for my girls and my nieces and nephews or nieces to go to school. And I'm constantly saying, don't binge drink and don't let anybody touch your drink or, you know, whatever it is. Is there anything beyond the kind of self-defense story that you wish you had known or tools you wish you or your parents or whomever had to make this, for lack of a better word, like a more palatable experience? I know that's impossible, but you know what I mean.
No, if you get the chance to watch the clip or if you've seen the piece that had aired on Outside the Lines, I mean, I really thought I had done a pretty good job of avoiding those situations. I really did. And my assault happened while I was sleeping in my room in my apartment. I just didn't lock the door to my specific room, and that's when my assault occurred. So I had felt that I had done everything, and I really blamed myself, I mean, afterwards, for what had happened.
Would there have been value if you had seen a story on how campus police and investigators in the school and everything goes through those kind of processes? Would that have had any value to you as a high schooler entering college or no?
Probably, because I think what happened to me, you don't think it's going to happen to you. You don't think it's going to happen to anyone you know, anyone in your circle. And I can tell you that my immediate family, I mean, it has changed their viewpoint drastically. I mean, they are probably having more in-depth conversations with their sons and daughters about what's happened to me and how you can avoid situations of that nature. And
And just to add to that, I think those stories are important, and the movement in general is now towards bystander intervention, which is now, and that's a really interesting story to start looking at. We don't know if it's effective, but this idea that we are all part of this story and that we need to train us all to be aware when there are very beginning signs of something amiss and how to intervene before it gets to that point. And it's very interesting.
Actually, as a journalistic matter, I don't think I've seen a really good story about that investigates bystander behavior on college campuses. And I think that might, if we're looking for future directions and how to keep this story fresh, looking at bystanders among students, faculty, and others might well be a very interesting line of inquiry. Yes.
Hi. I'm Katie Park from Rutgers University, and I'd like to know your stances on accompanying documents to a story that were produced by the university. So this would include, an account of the hearing and the sanctions leveraged against the perpetrator, but that were provided by the victim or the survivor. And I'd like to know when you think it's appropriate to accompany an article, if ever.
When it's appropriate to what? I'm sorry?
Can
you repeat your last question?
I'd like to know when you think it's appropriate to accompany these documents to a story, if ever.
Should you be putting the campus adjudication documents as part of the story?
Oh, that's a tough one.
Right now we're dealing with a situation in a story. The move right now is schools threaten people involved and tell them that they will breaking the law if they provide it to media members as a way to scare them. I think it's a little different state by state, exactly. And it's very confusing, because if they hand it over, like, we wouldn't get in trouble for putting it out, but they could get in trouble. So it's really,
it's tough. I would suggest, you call up the Student Press Law Center. They have lawyers there who will help you, and they would know what's specific to your state and whether, are you in a public university or in a...
Oh, Rutgers, yeah, it's a public university.
Yeah, okay, it's a public university, so you have much more leeway. But I would suggest calling them up and asking for advice and describing. It also depends on what the nature of the documents are.
They were text
and
messages.
And who's identified, are other people there? Because student privacy is very tricky. Mm-hmm. It's a minefield, and universities could get into trouble if that.
Let's try to get these last two questions in. Thank you.
Hi, Amber Johnson, first-year political science major at Spelman College. And my question is, what do you do when administration gives how to not get raped tips after incidents happen on campus? So there's been emails that say an incident happened, and then there's, well, while you're out, make sure that you don't have on revealing clothes, traveling groups.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, there actually may be a story.
Victim blaming, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a story both in messages campus is giving victim blaming, but also a story from the world of evidence-based social science about what actually works and what doesn't. Very often we find campuses rushing to embrace solutions that there's actually no particular evidence basis for. And if you're looking for a kind of clear journalistic objective way of going at it, that's something to think about.
Also, how do you hold administration accountable? So, emails are sent out, and then you have the tag, you know where their office is. This is a very small campus. How do you hold them accountable as the press of the campus, as the student voice of the campus?
On my campus, students have taken an advocacy approach, and it's actually now been working, we hope. So students came together who wanted to complain and formed an advocacy group and then formed an alliance and slowly have actually worked into a student group to raise consciousness and to work with the administration, hopefully to improve things. So I think those are some solutions.
Thank you.
All right, let's do last question.
My name is Simone Landon. I'm an editor at 538 and a colleague. And so my question is actually, I think, more of a writing question. We've talked a lot about verifying your story and making it bulletproof and from that standpoint. But as a reader of some of this coverage and as an editor too, I've often been turned off by the storytelling and not when it's narrative insensitive, but I'm thinking of a particular case and I don't know if I want to call it out, but where it was very clear to me the story had been written by three men and it turned out that the editor was a man and it was sort of sexist in the way that it was talking about sexual assault and the trauma that happened in this pretty high-profile case. And I'm curious how you go about controlling for that. I'm a woman editor, so I can do what I can, but our staff is largely male, and if we have men writing about sexual assault, and this applies to a whole host of issues where you may not have the experience directly to write about the thing, what do we do with those kinds of cases?
Thoughts?
Language narrative. I mean, there's lots of this that's been written in this. There are guides that have been published by groups that are concerned about sexual assault. You just go online and search, you know, use of the proper sensitive language, for example. Not using victim-blaming language by describing how a woman dresses as if she's inviting the attack by her dress or her manner. Avoiding descriptions that seem to blame the victim and put the onus on the victim for not being raped as opposed to putting the blame on the rapist for doing the act. So there's sort of a set established best practices. Obviously, there's a whole history of bad reporting on rape, and from that whole history, there have been written all of these guidelines, and I think the DART Center
has a lot on this. I would also say that to me the best remedy would be to have all of your key reporters and editors, male and female, educated about sexual assault reporting and best practices. It's not often, it may seem to be gendered errors, and sometimes they are, but often it's a matter of who actually has already had a little bit of education on these issues. And again, not to be doing an ad, the DART Center does have a lot of stuff on this, on narrative and storytelling. The IRE Journal that Alana contributed to had a special issue on reporting on campus sexual assault, had a lot on this. Nicole really wanted to ask Teresa a question, so we're going to close there, I think.
Yeah, I think I have actually never asked her this, but I really wanted to know, after the Rolling Stone situation, why, as a survivor, why do you think it's important for journalists to get these stories right?
I'll give you a good example. Last night, riding the shuttle, I was just making conversation with this couple who were in Philly to do something different and told them, I'm speaking at a conference tomorrow about sexual assault. And the lady two rows behind me said, do you really think all those girls tell the truth? Well, there went the small talk. But that's why, because so we get, as Nicole mentioned, and it's not just about me, it's about other victims, but we are dragged through the mud, torn limb from limb, called, I mean, the worst imaginable things that I would never want my parents to read about their child ever. And it's so important to get it right, because there are so many of us that are telling the truth, and we do need help, and we need ways to navigate what to do and to get out there and to have other victims come forward.
I just can't think of a better place to stop, so we'll stop there. Steve and Sheila and Nicole, Alana, and especially Teresa, thank you.
Thank you.